Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, my guest is Michael Newton Keyes, author of the new book Unbelievable, Seven Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion. Keyes is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and a former Fulbright scholar. After earning a PhD in the history of science from the University of Oklahoma, he won research grants from such organizations as the National Science Foundation and the American Council of Learned Societies. Keyes currently serves as lecturer in the history and philosophy of science at Biola University and is on the board of directors of Ratio Christi, an alliance of apologetics clubs on college campuses. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Andrew, let's chat.
Yeah. So you've written this book that topples seven of the most popular and pernicious myths about science and religion. That's quite an achievement. In our first episode together, you gave us a preview of the book by touching on all seven myths generally. But in this episode, I'd like to start taking an in-depth look at each myth, where it comes from, why it persists, and the truth of the matter. Are you game?
Let's go for it.
Okay. So today, we'll look closely at the first myth you debunk in Chapter 1 of Unbelievable, the claim that a big universe is a problem for Christianity. Let me quote science popularizer Bill Nye, just to set the stage here. In his 2010 Humanist of the Year acceptance speech, he says, "I'm a speck on a speck, orbiting a speck, among other specks, among still other specks, in the middle of specklessness." Well, he was definitely playing to the crowd with that one, and yet, as you point out, Bill Nye is far from the first to express this idea. So how do atheists, past and present, try to make this a problem for religion?
Well, you know, in that very same speech, as he was accepting the Humanist of the Year award, he ended that little routine of, you know, specs among specs and so on to, "I suck," at the very end.
Yeah.
And everybody laughed. And of course, they understood that what he meant was religion, or the religious basis for human significance, that's what sucks.
Yeah.
Because later in that same speech, he actually said, "And yet we are significant because we have this massively evolved brain, and we're the ones that have figured out how big the universe is." So it's really a very selective sucking here. It's a certain targeting certain kinds of significance, and yet retaining for himself the, you know, "Hey, we're significant after all." It's just not in the old way.
Yeah, he wants to have his cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
Huh.
But he's funny, you know, and he has a serious point. If you're an atheist, I mean, this, you got to find significance somewhere. So, hey, why not just brag about your brain?
Yeah. Yeah, he is a funny guy. And I guess that's why he's still around, because it can be his scientific approach, but maybe it's a combination of everything. But, you know, he's not the only one that's been doing this. In fact, you point out that somebody, what was it, the 17th century, was talking about specks of dirt being the earth and everyone on it?
Yeah. There's a number of Christians during the Scientific Revolution who used similar language as Nye, ironically, and yet thought that humans were fully endowed with significance from their creator God. This significance included the ability to discover the universe. It's kind of like Nye, except it's a religious version of it, and Nye wants to have a secular version of it. You know, all the significance without the God, you know, that type of things. But yeah,
right.
During the Scientific Revolution, we've got that going on. One of my favorites is Blaise Pascal. You want me to tell you about him?
Yeah, please.
He's known for being a Christian apologist. You mentioned I affiliated with Ratio Christi, and some people think, oh, apologetics, that's just an axe to grind. You're not really doing scholarly work. Well, Pascal was a brilliant mathematician and scientist and a Christian apologist. So, and he definitely thought the universe was large. And I actually have a new argument in my book that he was a Copernican. Michael Crow, another historian of astronomy, he had an argument, but I've come up with a new one. And so I've actually broken some new ground in my book, and I'm really happy about that.
That's a treat for those picking the book up. You're saying scientists during the Scientific Revolution accepted both God's existence and a huge cosmos. What about ancient and medieval scientists? Did they accept cosmic immensity while also believing in God?
And that's where, if you're believing the myth, The answer would be, well, during the Middle Ages, maybe not or no. It's just a modern, scientific revolution discovery. But when you look at the details, let's go back to the ancient world, and we'll get to the Middle Ages in a bit. Just hang on, Andrew. So in the ancient world, we got the greatest of all astronomers, Ptolemy, 2nd century AD. And he said that the Earth the Earth is like a speck, except he used the word point, mathematical point. Of course, a mathematical point is that which has no dimension. If you go back to the original language of geometry. So he was saying, compared to the distance to the stars, the Earth is like a point, like a mathematical point. In other words, it's almost nothing. So that's in the ancient world. And then throughout the Middle Ages, this knowledge was completely retained and enhanced. So yeah, this knowledge of the universe being big, you had it there in antiquity among pagans, you had it in early Christianity in the ancient world, and throughout the Middle Ages. Huh. It's all continuously there.
So you point to the famous literary scholar C.S. Lewis as a great resource for debunking this claim. How does Lewis set up his argument?
By the way, Lewis makes little cameo appearances throughout my book. So if you're a fan of Lewis, you're going to love my book.
Yeah, you must like the guy.
Oh, yeah, he's brilliant, and he has a way with words. So
he really does.
Here we go. So, yeah, the way he sets this up is he says, look, if a medical doctor, let's say a forensic one, wanted to, let's say on CSI, determine whether someone was poisoned to death, the doctor would have to have a good idea of what the body, what he would detect in the body if the person had been poisoned or if he hadn't been poisoned. There'd have to be a clear objective difference.
Yeah.
And then it goes on to say, well, similarly, if you're going to say a huge cosmos is a God killer, you'd need to have a clear idea. Well, what would the universe be like if God didn't exist? And he says, we don't have such a clear idea. And he goes on to demonstrate that. One more thing he does in his kind of setup before going through the options. He says, humans habitually perceive space as three-dimensional, height, depth, length. And when we think of three-dimensional space, it's almost impossible to imagine an end to space. So humans imaginatively conceive of the universe as infinite. Of course, we're not saying that's a good scientific theory, but just imaginatively, humans naturally think that way. So that's another way he sets it up, saying, well, regardless of what you say about the size of the universe, humans are going to imagine it to be infinite or at least really, really big.
Yeah. Would atheists complain if our universe contained just our local celestial objects in the solar system?
Oh, I think they would find all kinds of reasons to complain. They might say something like, look at all that vast amount of empty space where there's no objects out there. If we just have our own little solar system, no God would have created such vast amounts of empty space. And Lewis says basically the same thing. So that's option one. And looks like God loses on that option.
Well, given that the cosmos is huge with many suns and planets, how would atheists complain regardless of whether these planets hosted life or not?
Yeah. Lewis, I like the way he puts it. He says, whether they're habitable or not. The odd thing is that both these hypotheses are used as grounds for rejecting Christianity. That's my Lewis impersonation, okay? So when you think about if there are billions of habitable planets, then the atheist is going to say, well, see, humans aren't special because there's all kinds of life forms out there. We're lost in a crowd of extraterrestrials. But on the other hand, if, let's say, virtually all the planets are uninhabitable, then the atheist is surely going to say something like, well, no God would have created trillions of sterile planets. What a lousy design.
Yeah. So either way, they have attack options.
Oh, yeah. They're quite flexible, huh?
But there's also good answers coming from those who do support religion and would believe in a Christianity.
Yeah, because I think Lewis's point here is something like this. Look, going back to the medical doctor, forensic scientist analogy, you should have a good idea of what the universe should be like if God didn't exist. And the point here is that you go through all the options and the atheist can say, see, God doesn't exist. See, God doesn't exist. So it's a rigged game. This is really not a truth-seeking enterprise. And so Bill Nye, he's a comedian, and he knows a lot of science, and he's able to spin this one particular way. But, you know, if things turned out differently, he could always spin it another way and still get God out of the picture.
Interesting. Well, what historic texts in the Judeo-Christian tradition show that a big cosmos is consistent with religion?
You know, Andrew, the two most quoted psalms by professional astronomers, not all of them were professional, most of them were gentlemen astronomers, over the past four centuries were Psalm 19 and Psalm 8. Of course, Psalm 19 is famous for the heavens declare the glory of God. Well, hey, if the heavens are declaring God's glory, you'd think if you got an infinitely powerful and rational God that he would, you know, make probably a big place, not a small place. The other psalm that is often quoted by professional astronomers over the centuries, and by the way, I have a database of 130 astronomy textbooks spanning four centuries. That's kind of in the backdrop of my book. So I'm working with some good data here, Andrew.
Yeah, it sounds like.
But Psalm 8 is a favorite among these astronomers, and there the psalmist looks up into the night sky and says, "My, I feel really, really small compared to this big universe. In fact, I even kind of feel insignificant." And yet, God, says the psalmist, has made us a little lower than the angelic beings and crowned us with honor and so on. And so that tension between I'm small and yet, hey, I am significant on a religious basis, a Judeo-Christian foundation, that's right there in the psalm. So that's nothing new to the modern world. That's an ancient idea. And so what this shows is astronomers quoting these passages and the original people living way back in the ancient world, they saw there was no inconsistency between the God of the Jews and later the God of Christians and a big cosmos. They go well together.
Yeah. What is man that you are mindful of him? Well, that's really neat that you've laid that out for us. Mike, we're going to talk further. We're going to look at each of these myths that you debunk in detail, but we can only do so much in each episode. So thanks for your time today. We'll take another look at the other ones at some point in the future here.
Thanks, Andrew.
Well, listeners, get your own copy of Unbelievable by Michael Keyes by inquiring at your favorite bookstore or shopping online. Find more episodes of ID the Future at idthefuture.com, naturally, or through your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.